Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is the number one New York Times bestselling author, David Baldacci. He's taking a brief respite from the stories of his popular characters, Will Robey, John Polar, Amos Decker, The Memory Man, and he's given birth to a new character in this latest novel, One Good Deed. This book is set in 1949 and tells the tale of World War II veteran Aloysius Archer as he's released from prison and ends up in Poca City on parole. He's hired to collect a debt for a local businessman named Harvey Pittleman from the debtor Lucas Tuttle, but things go awry very, very quickly. We've got a business rivals, a mistress named Jackie Tuttle, who's the daughter of the debtor. We've got the parole officer, Ernestine Crabtree, a slaughterhouse, Detective Irving Shaw. The town is full of secrets. David, your other books are set in the present day. When you write a book set in 1949, what do you do as an author, not necessarily for research, but how do you get yourself in the mindset of the late 40s?
You know, I love that time period, and I've watched a lot of great films that were set in the 40s and a lot of cool television series and certainly read a lot of great books. I'm a big Raymond Chandler fan, and that's right in this wheelhouse. So for me, it was just having the different mindset, and, you know, I didn't dress up in a three-piece suit with a fedora while I was writing the book, but I pretended that I was probably wearing something like that. And I needed to immerse the reader in that time period, and the way to do that is to very subtly, you know, place facts and figures and all that in a way that doesn't interfere with the story flow, but allows people to understand that this is not 2019. And I did that by sort of just subtly talking about, you know, the clothes they wear and the lingo they use and the food that they eat and the cars that they drive and how the towns look and the fact that nobody has a cell phone and you go to a Rexall drugstore phone booth if you want to make a call and you got to drop the coins in and all that. So it was a little bit here and there, but that was vital to get people to understand that, you know, this is a different time period and that Aloysius Archer was operating, you know, in 1949, which was a fascinating time period for the whole country. It was a time period of transition. You know, the war was over. People were still picking themselves back up, but people were on the move. You know, they were going, a lot of people east were going west to seek fame and fortune, and a lot of times there were great fortunes made, and other times there were great fortunes lost. So, but it was really, you know, it was a look in the mirror for the people, for Americans, because they had just won this incredible war at an enormous price, and they were trying to figure out what was next in their lives.
I kept thinking of the Roman Polanski film Chinatown as I read this book, and I don't know why, but I did, and I've loved that movie. And did you have that movie in mind?
Absolutely. Chinatown is one of my favorite movies of all time, and I've actually got a script, one of the original scripts that Robert Towne wrote. And my other probably favorite movie is Big Sleep with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren McCall.
Yeah.
And I kind of had both of those in mind when I was writing this. Sometimes when I had, you know, Irving Shaw, the detective that Archer works with, you know, Bogey would come up in my mind, kind of this sort of hard scrabble and, you know, mentor for him. Absolutely, and that helped me put myself in the moment. And I have to say, while I was writing this book, a couple of times I would go and just, you know, put a DVD in and watch some scenes from there to kind of set that moment for me and put myself in the mood while I was writing this book. Because again, that was important. I had to sell the atmosphere to the reader, and it's not as easy as it might seem.
With the location, Poca City, it reminds me of the Springfield in The Simpsons, because the reader doesn't really know where it's at. And you drop a few hints throughout the book, but you never pinpoint it. And I thought it was in one area of the country, but then you'd mention something else that would disprove that. So where did you picture Poca City in your mind?
Yeah, if you were to take your finger on the map and go down to a state like Oklahoma, you would not be far off. And, but I purposely didn't name the state because I wanted to have a little bit of uncertainty, a little bit of mystery there, and let people arrive at their own conclusions, you know, like you did as well. But the important thing about it was that it was a small town that wanted to be something special, something big, and there were people there with ambition. Hank Pittleman had this great ambition to build something, and he wanted to make a lot of money off of it, and Lucas Tuttle wanted to do the same, just in a different way. So it was almost like people were trying to empire build in the small town. And that happened a lot back in the 40s. People were trying to race to make sure that wherever they lived was the winner in this big lottery that happened after World War II. So that was important to make sure that people understood that.
Well, Aloysius Archer, the main protagonist, he has a storied past with his World War II service, and that develops throughout the book, and then his time in prison. How do you give him such an everyday man quality, yet he has street smarts and bravery that seem like a lot of us wouldn't have?
Yeah, you know, I needed to give him those skills in order to make it plausible that he would be able to survive all the stuff that I threw at him in this book. And it is a lot. I mean, it's one thrill after another in this. But I think the big thing that I did was I had to make sure that he was vulnerable. And you make people vulnerable by making sure that they're not always right and they make mistakes and they screw up like we all do, and then they have to hurry up and try to fix it, or they have to suffer the consequences. And that's certainly something that Archer did throughout the book. He wasn't perfect throughout the book. He made mistakes, he made misjudgments, but he kept picking himself back up and he kept trying. And I think that's the way that people understand that this guy isn't every man. He's not Superman. He's always going to win. He's not going to walk into a room with 12 guys and beat them all up. He's going to use his wits and whatever skills he has in order to survive. And sometimes he's going to mess up. But the cool thing about that is that when you do fall down, you get a chance to get back up. And that's what I asked of him throughout this entire book, to keep getting back up.
We hear World War II stories from not only Aloysius Archer, but also Detective Irving. And it took me back to when I would hear my grandparents and godparents talk about their service in World War II. Did you have that same experience with family members?
I did. My father actually was old enough to have fought in World War II. He was 17 when he volunteered. Many young men were. And probably 8 or 9 of my uncles all fought in the war as well. And fortunately, all of them came back. They were all in different service branches. So I had those stories grow up in my life as well, and it was a very different time period. And not just, my dad used to tell me that he'd come home on leave, and he said the funny thing was that you would never see another young man, ever, in the streets. But if you did, they were all in uniform. And I think that's what people miss out today is, you know, we have a super strong army, obviously, with the greatest military in the world, but there are probably less than 1 million people in the U.S. military right now. Back during the height of World War II, there were like 15 million men in the armed forces. And it's just a different time period and a different magnitude of service. So that stuck with me, that it was everybody, you know, had a family member who was fighting. That's just not the case anymore, which I think sometimes makes it easier for us to fight wars, which is a bad thing, because most of us aren't personally, you know, touched by it. But back in World War II, that was not the case. Every family was touched by it.
This era, the late 40s and even into the early 50s, was when a lot of single men lived in downtown hotels, and that happens to be in the book. There's a setting there. How did this particular setting open up possibilities for action, given the unique demographic makeup of that living situation?
Yeah, you know, in a book like this, you could either really go big or small. You could do a huge stage. I could have set them in a big city with a lot of stuff going on and then touched in very shallow ways all the elements of that city. Instead, I wanted to take him to a small town that, again, wanted to be something big. And because of that, I had a finite footprint to work with, but that allowed me to really dig my fingers deeply into the dirt of Ponca City. And you got to see, you know, really what was going on in that town, the major players, you know, what the town felt like, the elements that were there, where people lived, what they did for work, and all the rest. And I think that really... that tethered people to the story in a way that I probably could not have done if I had set it in New York City or Chicago, places that were already established and people knew all about. So I could create this fictional town and build it exactly the way that I wanted it, so in a way that it suited the story that I wanted to tell perfectly. And that was just a decision that I made as an author.
I'm chatting with David Baldacci about his brand new novel, One Good Deed. It's available now wherever fine books are sold from the good folks at Grand Central Publishing. David, there's another great character in this book, the parole officer, Ernestine Crabtree. And at first, when I met her, she reminded me of Marion the Librarian from The Music Man, a strong single woman in a small town in a man's world. She had to be fun
right.
to develop.
She really was, because as you read the book, you understand that she has a tragic past as well. And I like taking a character and introducing, as I did, Ernestine, and to make readers say, okay, you know what, I've got her. First chapter that she's in, I understand her. I put her in a little box, labeled her. I know everything that I need to know about her. And then I sort of blow that all up as the book goes on. And she evolves and changes, and she becomes something else that you didn't realize she was going to be when you first were touched by her in the chapter she appeared in when Archer went to his parole meeting. So she was a character that I gave a lot of latitude to, and I knew going in that the first blush that readers had with her was going to be far different from the last one that they had. And that was fun, because in knowing that, I knew that it was going to be a surprise for most people. But I wanted them to understand that, you know, human beings, you know, you can't judge them through one meeting, and you can't judge them when they're in a particular element, in a particular environment, because all of us are different people depending on where we are, what sort of groups we're in, and what we happen to be doing at that moment in time. We're chameleons. We change sometimes. And Ernestine Crabtree, sort of a great way for me to let readers know, you got to pay attention. Don't put anybody in a box. Don't put a label on them, because they're not always what they seem to be.
The law enforcement techniques we see in the book, because there's criminal activity here, it's based on a lot of hunches, because there was little forensic evidence analysis back then, let alone DNA. How much did this complicate the development of the investigations as you wrote that?
It, you know, you're right. There was no CSI to be had in this book. Nobody's going to send stuff to the lab, and they're going to have the computers run it down. So, but what that does is, and I think the detectives back then maybe had a better feel for it than perhaps detectives do today, is it's just a feel for people, and to sit down and be dogged and ask the questions and look at the body language and listen to the answers and be skeptical and cynical and not believe. And for Irving Shaw, the detective, you know, his key word in this was corroboration. You know, he didn't believe anybody until he was able to prove it from another source that it was true. So I think you just had to rely a lot more just on your human instincts and skills and reading people. And during the course of the novel, that's what Shaw tried to teach Archer. That, you know, don't believe everything that people tell you. Don't share information that you don't have to unless you have a really damn good reason to do so. And be mistrustful, because people can be really deceitful. So I think it really was just, you know, hunches and guts and looking at people and being skeptical and just not believing something until you prove it, you know, three different ways. And that's a lot of what detective fiction was back then, but that's also how a lot of real detecting was done back then, because again, you didn't have the CSI, you know, crime labs backing you up.
There's a courtroom scene in the book, and it kind of made me chuckle, because it seemed more like a small claims trial than a criminal trial. But as a lawyer with many more constitutional safeguards in place since then, was it like nails on a chalkboard to write about how criminal procedure looked 70 years ago?
Boy, it was stacked. I mean, you know, it's still stacked against the defendant today. But, you know, back then, can you imagine not being provided a lawyer?
No.
And, you know, if you were going to be tried and you couldn't afford a lawyer, you had to either plead guilty, which many of them did, to avoid it, or, you know, stand up and represent yourself as counsel. That's unheard of today. Or the fact that the police don't need a search warrant. You know, they can go in and toss your room. They can force you to answer questions, and you don't need to have a lawyer present. This is a whole different world back then. And so for the courtroom scene, for me, it was fun to write, just because I knew in many ways how today, you know, reading that scene, you'd be like, there's no way. But I think it's an eye-opener for people, because I want them to know, you know what, back in 1949, this had happened. This could happen. It never should have happened, but this is the way, you know, it was back then. So be very, you know, appreciative of the rights that you have today and the safeguards you have today, because I would imagine back then, the way that the system was built, there were a lot of miscarriages of justice.
There's some scenes in the book about a slaughterhouse, and they're very vivid the way you describe them. We have packing houses here in Iowa where I live, and a lot of people who work there, from what they tell me, the process, things haven't changed a whole heck of a lot. What was your experience with that industry, to put that in here?
Yeah, it was, even though I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, there was actually, they had some slaughterhouses, because I also live near Smithfield, Virginia, which is, you know, the big pork company, the mm-hmm. bacon and sausage and all that. So the hogs they had there, you know, they say they have a more humane way of killing them now. I think it's like an electrical charge or something, that, you know, they're electrocuted to death. But look, you know, if you want the meat, you have to kill the animal. And back then, you would hit them with a sledgehammer. Now you electrocute them. But it's still a slaughterhouse. You know, there's no way to put, you know, any type of positive spin on this. And for me, I just wanted to, you know, like Irving Shaw said, after going to the slaughterhouse, he was never going to eat another pork product in his life, because you kind of pulled the curtain behind, you know, and you could see what went on behind the scenes. But it was also, you know, for me, kind of a metaphor, because Archer, you know, being there, a slaughterhouse, it doesn't have to be just, you know, non-human animals that are slaughtered. He was looking at, you know, a lot of danger and a lot of violence. And what happened to the slaughterhouse, I think, was not only an eye-opener for him, but he understood exactly where he stood with some of the people in that town and what they might try to do to him, and that he could end up being just like one of those hogs.
All right. The new novel from David Baldacci is One Good Deed. It's available wherever your fine books are sold. Also, if you want to learn more about David's writing process, go to masterclass.com. I see he's got a masterclass series up there that he is sharing his wealth of knowledge with everybody. David, another fantastic offering. Always look forward to him and love this one. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I always enjoy it, too.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
Ghost riders in the sky.